Richard, you're not going to keep doing crosswind practice. I respect that. You're going to take the longest of the three options. You're going to have to taxi all the way back to runway 21, take off in such a way that you don't conflict with the other two airplanes because you're going across their pattern. You're going to fly away from the airport, and then you're going to come back in. Let's suppose one, you wait till one of them is on downwind, one of them's on base. You're ready to go on 21. The two airplanes are off to your right. You see them both. You can deconflict. There's nobody else there. Launch, turn right, join them. You're good. Why is it worth going all the way away from the airport and coming all the way back and reestablishing SA coming back in?
Well, a couple of reasons. So the latter part of that scenario you described is static. That's how it's going to exist at one particular spot in time. The rest of the time you're doing your patterns and they're doing theirs, it's going to be completely different. And with three airplanes making radio calls and one of them making non-standard calls to a non-standard runway, to me, that's just where it pushes over the edge and it's too much, right? I could do it one-on-one and have enough space where you could listen in for arriving traffic, but with another airplane there, I just don't think you could do it repeatedly in a flow. And the other reason is, Jeff, I'm now on a religious crusade about arriving into patterns a standard way. And I have to confess that I wasn't always that way. But seeing these mid-airs that have happened with people arriving into patterns in non-standard fashion, and realizing what I'm asking of myself is usually a couple of minutes to join part of this great community we have and fly like I'm part of a community instead of flying like I'm this solo pilot existing only for my own, you know, self-benefit. That's, to me, the trade-off there is much more in favor of fly like you're part of this great community. Fly a standard pattern.
All right. So just get yourself out of there in a non-conflicting way. Separate the task from getting yourself back in, entering the pattern, and then be a good neighbor with the other airplanes. I get it. Tom, your choice is actually 2/3. So explain to me what you mean there. You're favoring doing exactly what Richard won't do. Climb, turn right, and climb, if necessary, the rest of the way to join that pattern.
Well, I answered that way because I'm trying to be honest with myself. This scenario could have easily described a very normal day for me instructing in an airport in the Wichita area. We have one just to the east of town called El Dorado. It has two virtually identical runways that are at 90 degrees to one another, neither of which is into the prevailing wind. And so I very frequently like to take students over there, do some takeoffs and landings into the wind, as closely into the wind, and then exit the pattern and come back and do some crosswind landings. And very frequently out there, we can get some maximum crosswind component landings in using the other runway. When I do that, very frequently, I'll brief the student, we're going to depart here, then we're going to maneuver to the downwind. If the spacing was correct with those other two airplanes, that I could do that without interrupting their flow, and I could tell them that I'm going to do that without interrupting their flow, I would essentially be probably end up number three for the pattern if that worked out. If that spacing worked, I would take off and maneuver to follow the preceding traffic in the pattern. If I didn't have that spacing or if I didn't have both airplanes in sight, I'd do like Richard says, get away from the airport, re-enter the pattern.
So by analogy, what you're saying is the departing the pattern coming back is like your go around on your attempt to join without going away. You're going to make the attempt to join. If it doesn't work, I'm going to go around. I'm going to go out and come back in the more predictable way. John, you kind of had the exact reverse, but is your thinking pretty much the same? Like you're thinking, yeah, my plan is to go out, but oop, I got an opportunity. I'm going to join.
Well, yeah. So I would pre-plan my departure that I'm going to go out and turn and come back. But it's also very situationally dependent. This is a fairly high elevation airport, and depending upon the time of year, but you got a turbo 182. So if you can make 1,000 feet by the departure end of the runway, which is traffic pattern altitude, and 9066B says you make your crosswind turn at the departure end of the runway, or 300 feet below if you're staying in the pattern, but don't climb into the downwind. And because you don't really have a crosswind leg here, you would be turning right into it. So if I was at 1,000 feet at the departure end, I'd probably just make the right turn into the 1-3 downwind. If I wasn't, then I would have to go out, keep climbing, turn around, and come back and re-enter level. So So that's kind of the difference.
So you're kind of saying that if you can make pattern altitude before you enter that downwind leg, you're basically doing an alternate entry that's perfectly approved by the aim of I'm at pattern altitude and I'm just making a turn onto the downwind. Is that an accurate sort of summation?
And it's to me, that's less dangerous than going out on a 45, turning around. You're turning your back to the traffic now as you're doing that and coming back in. So you can keep everybody in sight doing this. But it's very situationally dependent.
Dave, you're wasting no time at all because this airplane is at the Bravo taxiway, could make a quick hook over onto the back taxi for runway 13. You got a place to turn around and then, hey, you're there. You're with the other airplanes. What's the thinking behind that?
Well, it's really not speed. It's just courtesy. You know, I can hear my mom's voice in my head saying, you know, be courteous. Don't be a selfish jerk. You've already had two of the landings that you wanted to do. Now, if you want to do more, get in line. You know, Richard's got a good point about the potential conflict with an airplane on final. I'll wait to back taxi on runway 13. There's the courtesy aspect, and there's a little bit of a morality question, too, because, you know, if I want to accept a higher risk for the type of flying that I want to do, and if I want to do low-level aerobatics or I want to do fly in crappy weather, it's like, that's my responsibility, but I don't have any right to put anybody else at any higher, at any elevated risk. You know, I'm not gonna fly a conflicting pattern, even if I'm confident that I can do it. It's like, it imposes some additional risk on the others. Morally, that's not my choice. I can't do that for them. I can't, you know, that's not my right to make that choice. So I'm just going to try to be courteous. I'm going to wait. I'll back taxi. I'll join the flow. I haven't flown in a while. There's plenty of legit practice things, plenty of benefit that I can do, that I can gain from landing into the wind, whether it's precision landing, spot landing, short field landings. There's lots that I can do that will help knock the rust off and still be, you know, part of the community.
So there are actually two things in your answer. I want to pull the two of them apart. One is joining the pattern for runway 13, and one is the decision not to keep working the crosswind practice, right? And you're sort of saying like both of them are the most courteous is kind of what I'm hearing, right? You're not gonna be flying this pattern where there's a potential conflict, but you're not even gonna depart across their pattern.
Right.
It's a safer, more courteous thing to wait your turn and do the back taxi.
Exactly. And even, you know, I'm gonna turbo 182. I can climb pretty fast. They're making right traffic. There's a potential, you know, risk for them. So it's like, I am not going to impose that on them. I'm just going to try to be courteous. You know, I've already had my two crosswind landings. I'd like to do more. Tough luck. You know, we're going to do something else.
Well, let's bring this over to you, JP, and take that question right off of what Dave was saying. Your plan was 3. You're going to fly straight out and come back around to stay in the pattern. But that is going to take you over an aircraft that is landing potentially, right? There's a landing aircraft on a runway who may go around. So you're going to have to time along that. And you're in a fast climbing airplane potentially. So you could have a conflict on the downwind. Is that because you've been thinking runway 21 all along that you're even departing runway 21? And let me rephrase the question another way. If you were at the ramp, let's suppose equidistant to taxi out for back taxi or taxi to 21, you were just departing the area. You got to take a runway. Would you really go to 21 and take off across the other pattern if you were just departing? Or would you back taxi? Are we stuck in the box because you were on runway 21?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. As a pilot, and we're kind of forced into this a bit at this airport because the taxiway is not constructed yet on that particular runway, I'm not a huge fan of back taxiing an aircraft on a runway. Just I do it. Some of the airports I operate in, we have to. I still think on the ramp, you know, I can get the position where those other two aircraft are located. I probably still may take off on 2-1 and then extend out and then enter the pattern into 45 and then follow everybody else. I'm definitely not going to be working the crosswinds when everybody else is using that other runway. I'm just not going to do that. I think it's manageable, but it's going to be challenging, especially with a couple other aircraft in there. And like Richard said earlier, right off the get-go, it's pretty easy. Everything's static. But once we start getting in the flow, that's going to be a little bit more challenging. But I think flying that predictable pattern once we get into the air is the way to do that. But I didn't choose the back taxi just because I'm not a huge back taxi guy.
You know, it's interesting you say that about the back taxi, because I think it has a lot to do with how you, quote, for lack of a better term, grew up in aviation, right? If you grew up in a place where there were lots of back taxis, you don't think about a back taxi. I don't care. But if you were always operating from airports that had taxiways, a back taxi is like terrifying. I'm driving the wrong way on the highway. It just feels so wrong. Wally.
I've always, for a long time, been aware that many mid-air collisions occur in the traffic pattern, but Richard's statistic is just alarming to me, that 80% of them occur in the traffic pattern. Given that's, you know, such an undesirable end to your flight, I don't see why.
And premature end to your flight, too.
I don't see why we wouldn't take every precaution to do it exactly the FAA-recommended and safest way. So that's why I chose his selection. In doing flight reviews with pilots, I'm appalled how many of them will come across midfield 500 feet above the pattern and then make a 45 descending turn into the downwind from inside. And it happens 30% of the time, which is obviously the most dangerous way to enter the pattern. You can do it.
Right. It's the worst case scenario. And that's the, you know, climbing into the pattern, we created something really unusual here, but certainly descending into the pattern, frowned upon everywhere I've ever seen, right?
Yeah.
But you still, on departing, are crossing that other pattern off runway 21. That's still more desirable to you than the potential conflict of a back taxi. If we're talking about a collision, the only risk on the back taxi is you're looking at an aircraft that's landing there, hopefully looking at you, and you can see long beforehand that there's a pending problem here, and you can yell at each other. Yeah. Worst case scenario, you could dive off into the gravel on the side of the runway here. No one's going to die from that. It's still worth departing 2-1? Or have I convinced you?
No, you didn't convince me.
I tried.
The dive off the gravel part kind of took me back to where I was.
I should have stopped while I was ahead.
You had me up until there.
What about arriving at this airport? Because we've created an unusual situation here, but obviously we're looking for places that it's applicable to other things. If you were arriving at this airport, if you're arriving at Berlin, is it perfectly acceptable then to, you know, come in and land across on that crossing runway? You know, you're shaking your head no, Wally, like, no, that's not okay. Even though you could land and stop short, well short of that runway, theoretically.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the issue is being courteous, number one, and number two, doing predictable things. And that's an unpredictable thing. Sure, you can probably get away with it, but you don't know if you have student pilots in the pattern. You don't know what their reaction is going to be. And again, why not spend just a minute or two longer to reduce this 80% chance of, or at least bring that down as low as we can, of a mid-air collision?
Right. And it speaks to what Dave was talking about, I think, about putting other people sort of at any elevated level of risk. John.
So in addition to the airborne conflict that we've talked about here, my real concern would actually be more the ground conflict. I think the airborne conflict you could manage. If you saw somebody that was above you or below you on a downwind or something, you can maneuver. What I'd really be concerned about would be meeting at the intersection. Okay, you've got a crosswind, it's a fairly high elevation airport, so you got a higher ground speed, you might be playing with the throttle, trying to milk it down, and all of a sudden 4,000 feet of runway go by and you're standing on the brakes trying to stop before 1-3. The pilot's original plan was to land and hold short of 1-3, okay? Mm-hmm. Basically a lasso operation. And you think about what we do at towered airports with lasso operations. It requires a staff study. It requires runway marking, specific training for the controllers. All this stuff goes into place to make this lasso operation. They have charts with certain airplanes that are allowed to do it. Here we have somebody who's just decided to invent the lasso on his own. And it's very much line up and wait at non-towered airports. You know, another one of my pet peeves, you hear people do that. Those operations belong in a certain environment, and you shouldn't be making stuff up as you're going along here because of that.
Richard, I have to go back to you for that. Let's suppose one of these airplanes departs, and you said, oh, okay, one departed. I'm going to ask the other pilot, is this okay if I practice on 2-1? Well, the pilot's like, okay. And now you're going to deconflict, as you said. So it's a two-part question. What do you think to John's comment of you're doing kind of a off-the-cuff land and hold short? And two, can you really say that you can unilaterally deconflict, that you're really taking all that on for both of you?
Yeah, so I think, I like John's comment. I don't consider it a land and hold short operation if I were doing that. I would never come in and land where I thought there was such a conflict that I was going to have to hold short. I wouldn't do that. But the notion that can I deconflict with another airplane in the pattern, I totally feel like I could do that comfortably. And it rests on a couple of assumptions. One is that the entire responsibility for deconfliction is mine. So it's important that I stay out of his way and that I establish deconfliction, which is why I mentioned I tell him, if you just fly your standard pattern, I'll stay out of your way and do crosswinds. So yeah, I feel like I could do that.
Dave. What if the shoe was on the other foot and the other pilot is going to deconflict with you? What if you show up somewhere and say, and say, hey, don't worry your little head about me. I'm out here just doing my thing and I'm not a problem for you. You know, it's like, would you trust that?
You know, Dave, I feel like I would, because I feel like I could also keep an eye on it close enough to where if I got uncomfortable with it, I could just call and knock it off.
I wouldn't. It's like, hey, not your call. You know, I don't know who this pilot is. I have no idea what their skill level is. It's like, that's a non-starter.
Right. And then there's a level of distraction for you now, even if you're circling around, like, who is this other person? And the same thing, you know, Richard, put you back where you're handling the deconfliction. Aren't you adding to the stress level potentially of another pilot? You can't get in the, maybe they're just like, I really wish this guy would stop with this, you know, this thing. I said yes, but now I feel like this is making me really uncomfortable. I can see you nodding over there, Wally. I want to go to you on that.
Well, you pretty much made my point.
Go.
It's a great distraction to the other pilot. And that's the issue. And we don't know how much distraction that pilot may or may not be able to handle without getting in a little trouble. So it's not being part of the community, is the term Richard used.
Tom.
This whole discussion reminds me of part of my briefing that I give students when I fly with them. And it's about the responsibilities of the flight. And I told them, whomever I'm flying with, regardless of their level of experience and currency, I tell them that fly the airplane as if you're alone in the airplane. Your primary responsibility is to act as pilot in command of the aircraft, whether or not they're actually the PIC. The pertinent part here is that I tell them that my primary responsibility as the flight instructor is to assure the safe outcome of the flight. Teaching them something is a high secondary priority, but primarily I'm here to make sure that these things turn out all right. And that gets back to this whole discussion, do I continue to do my crosswinds even though I have now conflicting pattern or traffic in the pattern that is adhering to what would be considered to be the proper way to fly the aircraft? This would be a point where I would just simply say, we are going to have to dispose of this crosswind training task in order to fulfill our primary responsibility of assuring a safe outcome of the flight and to be a community, be with the community, and go with the flow. So all of the discussion about would I modify things to try to do, whether or not it's a land and hold short, or I'm going to try to deconflict for you, I think our responsibility, even if I were solo in the airplane in this training exercise, that's when I would call a knockoff, and I would say, okay, I'm no longer going to practice crosswinds. I'm going to go with the flow. Then you can discuss how you get into the flow, which is what we're doing here. But the whole idea of continuing that practice in opposition to traffic that is doing the right thing, I think that needs to go.
Well, you bring up a really interesting point about being the instructor in the cockpit here, because as instructors, we're often trying to conspire this sort of situation and move the shells and balls around in order to create the right experience, right, for the student. And we're split attention, right? So we're dealing with the student and we're dealing with the situation around us. So you don't have the whole full focus of attention all the time on there. Would you do this, Tom, with just one other aircraft in the pattern, this kind of crossing at a non-towered airport with a student?
No, I wouldn't. And I say that from my own experience because I know that this does happen sometimes at that airport near Wichita. And that's when I discontinue doing the crosswinds. So that's been my experience that I make the decision to stop doing that training exercise.
Dave?
This is not an exactly analogous situation, but I remember there was a, in my former home airport, there was a student going out to do his first solo. And he's, you know, and his instructor standing there watching. He's doing his first solo in a Cessna 150. A twin comes in and lands downwind. There's maybe 6-8 knots of wind. He lands downwind. This is a cargo pilot. He's just hustling, landing on the nearest runway. The student pilot decides that, wow, you know, I was gonna take off on the other runway, but I guess this is the runway in use. And, and takes off downwind and just staggers into the air and barely clears the obstacles. And it's like he was just taking his cues from the more experienced pilot. And it's like it was almost disastrous. And so I have no idea what the experience level of the other pilot is, or, you know, Richard mentioned, possibly Nordo traffic, more traffic coming into the pattern. Are they just going to, blindly follow me to the crosswind runway? You know, it's possible. I've seen it happen.
Now, doesn't that speak to the community aspect that you were talking about, Richard? That it's like, look, it's a community of pilots, and inadvertently we can kind of suck some people into something that they're not comfortable with because they're trying to work with us. Or like, hey, oh yeah, crosswind practice, that's great. Let me raise the sort of stakes one more to you, John. If this was a towered airport and now there's a controller who's helping arbiter all this, you want crosswind practice and you're like, hey, I'd like closed pattern on the crossing runway. How does ATC feel about that?
No problem. As long as the traffic level is manageable and the runway configuration lends itself to that. There's a towered airport near us where I routinely take people for that. And, you know, sometimes it's also a big training base for one of the local commuters, and they routinely do the same thing. And many times it's two runways going, and they've got practice approaches on one, touch and goes on another, and the controllers work it out. But they've got the tools and the authority to do that. They can say extend downwind, give me a 360 on the downwind, make a short approach, all the stuff to deconflict mainly the intersection. That's what you're always protecting, is that intersection. They have the tools and the authority to do that. We don't really have that here. You can't tell the other airplane where to turn its base, you know? So, not that you can't work out something like that with communication, but you would have to work it out with a cooperative pilot.
Richard, one of the things you brought up in your response that I thought was fantastic was you don't need a crosswind to do crosswind practice, right? What are other things that someone should practice to work on their crosswind skills?
Well, I mean, any sort of slip, like a no-flap landing in which you're using bank and rudder to line up with the center line. And then there are just other skills, short field, soft field, spot landings, no flap. John mentioned the short approach. All those things are valuable skills for a rusty pilot to practice. And, to me, every bit is as important as crosswinds.
Wally.
Well, just a couple exercises I do. I do what Richard suggested too, was flying down the runway, practice crosswind landings by not landing. That's what I call it. But with the flight reviews and things like that, I will ask the pilot, I say, I'd like you to land on the 1,000-foot bar with your right wheel on the center line, and just give them some precision to work on. And usually they can do that pretty well. It makes them feel good. But if they can do that, they can probably handle a crosswind too. So it just, instead of just letting them land and accepting wherever the airplane touches down and whether it's left or right of the center line, give them some standard to make them better.
Wally, I'm going to stay with you for a moment here. You point out often about too many CTAF calls, right? There are certain, these are the calls you need to make, but now you're potentially doing something kind of non-standard. You know, the person behind you is now worried, like, he's not going to touch down, I'm going to have to go around and that kind of thing. Are there additional things that you're going to say on the CTAF beyond those, and then aren't you clogging things up to a certain degree?
Absolutely not. I'm not going to say a thing about it because it's what I'm doing over the runway. Mm-hmm. And the pilot behind me, it's his responsibility to space himself, and it's not my responsibility to land short or long to make that work for him.
Same thing with, like, short approaches or...
A short approach, I might announce that because maybe there's a pilot in position ready to go, and that might prevent he or she from pulling out in front of me. So I would probably announce that. But.
Yeah, so this is kind of non-standard things here. JP, you were talking about back taxi and just not really liking the back taxi. And I think there are probably other people who are listening or a little uncomfortable with that. From someone who regularly deals with a back taxi, what are the rules of etiquette there? It doesn't even get taught to a lot of people who go from based out of busy airports. Tom, you're kind of nodding over there. And just... quick advice. Somebody's like, Tom, how do I deal with this back taxi thing?
Well, when I begin the back taxi, I'll call that I'm back taxiing on, and there's some confusion. Let's say we're landing on runway 13. If you say you're back taxiing, use the number of the runway that is active at the time, not the other direction. Because you would be taxiing 31, you're back taxiing 13. But
right.
In any event,
good point. So good point.
You're not throwing out, and I think it was to Dave's point, if I start throwing out other runway numbers, that might cue somebody to do something wrong who overhears that. But I make a call initially. My plan is that I'm going to get to the other end of the runway, and I'm going to clear off of the runway. I'm not just going to turn around and go. That's typically what else. So I will call when I'm clear of the runway, and I'll say something like clear of runway 13 on the arrival end or something like that, so that they know that I'm up there. As I am taxiing, I know how hard it is sometimes as you're coming down final approach to see an airplane that is on the runway. Mm-hmm. So I do not taxi right down the runway center line. I offset myself so that the airplane is silhouetted against the runway and not lost in the white stripes. Make it a little bit more obvious. I'll even turn on strobes or something, keep the strobes on so that I'm really obvious as I'm back taxiing on the runway. And I do back taxi on runways a lot.
Yeah, I really like that. That's a great tip, the sort of offset, and then it doesn't look like you just landed in the other direction,
right?
Either with this perfect on center line landing.
True.
This person is either terrible at landing on center line or they're clearly doing something different here.
Yeah.
And that'll kind of stand out and make sense. You know, I got to go back to your response, Richard, because the word that keeps jumping out of my mind is community. At a non-towered airport, it's a team effort. The predictability you're talking about also makes sense. But at the same time, if you just practice the same old thing day in and day out, you get potentially good at one thing. So you've got to challenge your routine in places. You've got to kind of push your envelope to keep that envelope from collapsing. And yet you've still got to do it while respecting everyone else's needs. But you don't want to necessarily be shy because you might really be able to inspire somebody else to do something they need. And the first step, it sounds like, is asking them on the CTAF to join you.